This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 22nd December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 233 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's programme, we'll be heading into orbit on the International Space Station with Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield, a man who reignited interest in outer space.
And we'll be sitting down with the wonderful singer-songwriter Lloyd Cole.
Plus, we saddle up with author Tim Cope, a man who spent 3 years on horseback retracing the steps of Genghis Khan.
All that plus Aisha Spears will be here for a look at some of next week's big news stories, and we'll play some great music too, so stay tuned. It's episode 233 of the Monocle Weekly. And here we are. Happy Christmas, Andrew. I thought I'd give you a...
Oh, you put me an orange.
An orange, isn't it? That's a sort of traditional crap Victorian Christmas. Do you think anyone ever did get a Satsuma in their stocking?
Yeah, I do.
Really?
Yeah, I think people got Satsumas and nuts. Not the magazine, I point out.
I was a zoo man myself. Yeah, it's very traditional for me to get some interviews with some footballers saying sexist things about women for Christmas.
Every child had one.
Every child really needed that. Every child needed some weak puns about ladies' breasts.
Now, 3 years. That'd be a long time to be on a horse, wouldn't it?
We should say, shouldn't we? We should let a little bit of daylight in upon magic and say that we did slightly struggle. We had the giggles throughout that introduction. We normally read it out. We normally have the music bed underneath it as it is, but we couldn't quite get through it today.
I think that was 11 goes. Let's just point out, Tim Cope is an amazing guy and I'm really looking forward to meeting him. He's done a very interesting book. But whoever wrote the script, it says a man who spent 3 years on horseback. It just sounds like the poor guy couldn't even get off to have a wee.
No, nothing like that. Just constantly on it.
Poor horse as well.
Poor horse, poor man. Imagine the state of his balls.
The horse or the man?
The man.
Because that would be another story for nuts, I think.
So coming up next, we've got Aisha Spears. I think it's her maiden voyage, the captain of the news look ahead, isn't it?
Yes, because little Tommy's taking his tugboat elsewhere.
He's tugged off.
So why don't we pull her into the harbour?
Let's do it. And Tommy's tugboat has left, which means the news desk...
You're literally putting a piece of orange in your mouth every time you have a line to say.
Sorry.
It's like doing the show with a blender. The juicer bound.
I'm a consumer of everything. I like to constantly consuming something.
It doesn't mean anything. You're like a child. It doesn't mean anything. It's popped into your mouth.
I know. So it's unprofessional.
No, it was very professional.
Aisha's just really giving me a look.
I didn't know what was going
on.
She
really gave me a look then. Sorry.
So Aisha Spears has taken over from Tom Edwards this week.
I'm trying to look like him.
Danny Giacopelli's done this job as well. He normally comes in with a lot of paper.
Danny?
Yeah.
Does he? Yeah. And a boxy jacket.
Yeah.
I can run back up and get some more paper to look official.
Hey.
Where are you going to start your news review? I'm
going to start...
News preview. Why am I saying review? Preview.
In Russia... on Monday, we will see the release of a number of prisoners that Putin has so graciously allowed to leave jail thanks to this amnesty that he's granted, including the Greenpeace Arctic 30, the members of Pussy Riot, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And on Monday, they'll be going out. I mean, it's going to be, I think, between now and the Sochi Olympics. A full-on...
So it's a big PR thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, full-on discussion about how Putin's going to make this all look a little bit better.
Well, it is extraordinary. Yeah, Khodorkovsky has been his kind of like sworn enemy for 10 years in jail, during which time he's refused to budge. And it's funny because we've seen all these kind of demonstrations around the world over the kind of the gay issue. And you can tell, actually, he's slightly more stung by public opinion and world opinion than you'd imagine. You know, we've seen that, you know, Obama, for example, has said, you know, sorry, I'm a bit busy, I won't be able to come to Sochi. He hasn't said he's boycotting it. But we have seen other leaders say, actually, you know, the president of Germany said, I'm not coming, I don't like what you're doing. And suddenly he kind of, either that or someone gave him a joint last night, and because he's changed his character, isn't
Free
he?
Love.
He's got quite chilled out.
Yeah.
And they're sending Billie Jean King for the American delegation, which I think is a pretty pretty big deal.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that Khodorkovsky didn't seem to know that his team didn't seem to know that he was actually going to be getting out. There was all this like back and forth with his lawyers about whether or not he actually wanted to be out, if he'd sent an appeal letter or not. So I think next week we're going to see a lot of people talking about perhaps what happened to them, especially the Greenpeace Arctic 30 who get to leave Russia, what they actually went through.
Well, it's also tricky because, you know, Khodorkovsky's people are saying, OK, he didn't say pardon for various reasons.
Oh, pardon.
he didn't utter the pardon. He hadn't asked for a pardon. And same for the people who are being released by Greenpeace, who've been accused of hooliganism. Now they're being let out. You know, they're being pardoned, but they're saying, well, we didn't do anything. You know, so how can we be pardoned? So I think they all feel a little bit kind of like, oddly, they're probably a bit cheated of publicity going forward, you know, because it's like the game's up. When there's not going to be a trial, you're not going to get your chance to kind of talk to us about the Arctic in court.
But I wonder how far Putin can go with this over the next couple of months of making himself look better than he is in the run-up to Sochi. I mean, what else can he do? There's not much more he can do.
He can go on a gay pride march.
Yeah, I mean, that's not going to happen.
You just don't know.
He could do that, couldn't he? Give him another joint the night before.
Yeah. He's a gentleman who likes to be photographed with his top off. And
he does. He likes a fitted shirt.
Well, he seems to even have gone back on what he was saying about the NSA and Obama.
You've seen him in those fitted shirts. Looks like someone down the shadow lounge.
It is a good indicator. Is the shirt a bit too tight?
Yeah.
Maybe. And the other good indicator? I always think it's like, it's a good indicator of kind of gayness and also of gentrification. This is my index. My index, you can tell when a neighbourhood's on the up and when the gays have moved in, people like me. But anyway, it's when big guys with very small dogs.
Right, yeah.
Neighbourhood's changed.
Or that's just sorted. Hong Kong in general, because everyone has a tiny dog.
Yeah, I would have an Alsatian, I just can't fit it in my flat.
Although well, you do see that. You see people with like Alsatians and Great Danes, these tiny little women.
Yeah, but some Hong Kong gentlemen are not so big.
No.
But I mean, very big guy. Tiny dog.
Yeah.
Neighbourhood's changing.
It looks
it's
like
on
a,
the up.
Yeah. That should be part of the quality of life index.
It's like a bear taking a mouse for a walk.
Talking of quality of... quality of
Literally.
You could be John Lewis' Christmas dad.
Yeah.
We did talk about that, didn't we? The bear and the hare. It does sound like a gay disco.
Yeah. Okay, next.
So that's Russia done in classic political style.
Next is my old stomping ground of New York and the last week of Mayor Michael Bloomberg's term, which I think is actually really sad. I'm not particularly excited about Bill de Blasio. I know a lot of people are, but I think a lot's been done in the last 12 years. I mean, the next story is pretty serious.
Yes.
It's Britney Spears.
Whoa.
Rob, get ready.
Yeah.
She will kick off on the 27th of December, 2 years worth of concerts. I didn't even know that she could fill seats for 2 years. I honestly didn't even know that she was still making music. But 2 years, 50 shows a year in Las Vegas. Sunday, we would have seen a TV special to mark this new album and the beginning of these shows. And guess how much money she's making each show?
I don't know.
$300,000 a show. That's 50
quite something,
a year.
Isn't it? What happened? I mean, I think this is amazing stuff. Obviously, the big start, this was a sort of Rat Pack thing, wasn't it? This is where these sort of residencies started. Elton John did it really successfully.
Yeah. Barbra Streisand, I think.
Yeah. But what happens when you're a pop? You know, when the songs are fast, it's all about dancing. Do you know what I mean? That's a pretty grueling schedule. I wonder what that show is going to be like.
It comes with, the funny thing is, it's not that far from LA. I think those jobs, they come with like private jets to take you home at the end of the show as well. You come in and do the show and you kind of disappear. But anyway, 2 years, it's not as bad as 3 years on a horse.
Although the same dance moves can be applied.
I was going to say, hit me baby 51 more times this year.
She does look like she's been 3 years on a horse, but she's not. In the wind as well.
Poor old Britney. Poor Britney. I had a feeling Andrew was going to say that.
With the nose bag on. okay, sorry. It's Christmas.
I like that. That was a great news look ahead, wasn't it? It had light and shade in it, didn't it, Andrew? And it had seriousness, and we managed to give Andrew a bit of an urbanist fix.
Yeah.
As an inspirational mayor.
And you know what? Hit me, baby, one more time. That's what we should play at this point.
One more time. In an era of austerity, spending billions on the space race is no longer quite the fashionable hobby of governments with sky-high ambition that it once was. But in recent times, one man has done more to reignite enthusiasm for going on in the cosmos than anyone else, and he managed to do it within the space of about 5 minutes.
We're talking about Canadian astronaut Commander Chris Hadfield, whose playful cover of David Bowie's Space Oddity while aboard the International Space Station in early 2013 made him an instant global star. Astronauts like Hadfield are helping reset the agenda of how people go about their business 300 kilometres above the Earth, using recent advances in communication technology and social media to bring home their experiences like never before. Space is now fun again, inspiring even. Chris was in London recently promoting his book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, and Monocle's Tom Hall caught up with him to talk about it.
I wanted to ask you, firstly, a lot of the headlines that I'm seeing right now about space are mentioning snorkels in space, which sounds like the best sci-fi film ever. But I wanted to ask you about that, because that's something that you'll know about on the ISS.
They're about to do spacewalks on the space station to go fix a fairly serious problem. The space station's lost a significant percentage of its cooling, and they have to go replace a main module, a big pump, about the size of a refrigerator on the outside. Two, maybe three spacewalks. The last time we did spacewalks, they had a serious problem inside the spacesuit. The helmet started filling up with leaking cooling water, almost drowned the astronaut inside, an Italian named Luca Parmitano, and really serious problem. So we still have to do the spacewalk for the health of the station, but they want to have a backup plan just in case that unusual occurrence happened inside the spacesuit. They have two phased plan. Number one is a breathing tube so that if the helmet started getting wet inside again, they could just breathe through this snorkel tube that went down into the chest area of the suit, so you get dry air. And then also they've actually just taken a bunch of absorbent material, like out of a nappy or a diaper, and put it up in the back of the helmet so that if the suit started leaking water into the helmet, there'd be a way to soak up that water before it started sticking to the astronaut's head and maybe working around it and getting into their eyes and their ears and their breathing. So it's a complex business, and it's not as straightforward as anybody thinks, and we're still constantly learning things. So it's snorkels in space, which is a funny sound, but at the same time, we're just trying to do what makes sense and be safe and logical and go fix the problems as they occur.
I'm always amazed by, despite, you know, the billions of research which goes into these projects, we occasionally do hear about these things, as you say. It's a bit like putting a nappy in a helmet or just trying to get some kind of pipe so a guy can breathe. Do you find yourself having to think on your feet a lot in space like that? I mean, how much can you really plan for out there?
We train far, far more than anybody thinks. It's phenomenal, the years and years of preparation we go into. And yet, even with that, very seldom do things go as planned. You know, almost nothing goes as planned. But hopefully it will go within the scope somewhere of what you've prepared for. Very seldom do you just do your work A through Z and get everything done, as almost always something doesn't work right. Just, you know, like doing car repair on Earth or whatever, or fixing your refrigerator at home. It's not going to go like the manual. So we're just people. We're just in a different place. The key is we can't call anybody, and no one else can come help. We have to be able to deal with it no matter what crops up. So therefore, we end up getting a lot of training ourselves, trying to understand our equipment better. And then when the real problems occur, hopefully somewhere within all that mix of training and capability and maybe calls down to the ground, we can figure out how to solve the problem without breaking the equipment or hurting ourselves.
And you would be someone who may know a lot about perhaps planning ahead, because I've been reading the book, and you wanted to be an astronaut since you were about 9 years old. This is right.
Yeah, in fact, just before my 10th birthday is when I, as improbable as it sounds, that's when I made the decision to be an astronaut when I grew up. It was ridiculous. You know, it was, not only was it an incredible long shot, but I was Canadian. Canada didn't even have an astronaut program. It wasn't improbable. It was impossible. There was no route from here to there as a Canadian. But I was a kid, and people had just walked on the moon for the first time. The impossible had just become reality, and I figured that was pretty enabling, and things might happen in my lifetime, too, that were different. So I started pursuing it and trying to turn myself into an astronaut when I was 9 years old. And amazingly enough, I did, and I flew in space 3 times and even commanded a spaceship.
How important do you think polarizing moments like landing on the moon, where the entire world sits and watches, and perhaps a man singing Space Oddity in space, how important do you think they are to inspire young people?
I think unifying moments that rise above the noise of day to day are really important. They show people that there are things beyond the normal horizon that are possible and part of the human experience. The Olympics are not a bad example of that. Once every 4 years, we gather to push people right to the limit of human capability. And we do it as a competition because that pushes people often to do things they wouldn't have done otherwise. But the real beauty of the Olympics is that this is human accomplishment at the very edge of what is possible. And it becomes interesting just inherently to the entire world, no matter what country you're from. And a moon landing is in that category also. And if there's a way to share it, I mean, if the Olympics happened and no one could go to them, it wouldn't be nearly as interesting. But the fact that they're readily accessible, televised, interactive, so that you can share in it, that's what makes it really significant. The space station now is our first home away from home. It's where we have left Earth. We've been living there for 13 years, and technology has now made it accessible. So that if I choose to take a picture of something, I can share it with the people that are in the shot anywhere around the world, real time. Someone can ask me to take a picture of whatever, the wildfires near their home or a sunrise over top of their bay or whatever, and I can take that picture and they can see how they fit into the world. Or we can do something scientific, like figuring out what dark matter is made of, or we can do something artistic, like play an iconic song or write new music. And all of that is accessible to people in a very new edge of capability environment. And that is inherently interesting. And it's evidenced, it's proven, of course, by the moon landing, by the number of people that watched the Olympics, and also by the millions and millions of people that came on board the space station during my tenure up there.
I feel like your recent visit to the station, where you, of course, did perform your song, I mean, obviously that was a bit of fun, but I think it was really important because I think for the first time in a long time, it really gave the world a chance to kind of just look up there. Perhaps we've sort of lost that kind of sense of amazement, perhaps, because, people have been going to space for 40 years, well, 50 years, I think. But it just gave people an opportunity to see something up there which they could identify with and get behind more.
People can't make a value judgment about something if they don't know it exists. Right, and a lot of people don't know that there's a space station, even though it's the brightest star in the sky. And if you get up at dawn or sometimes at dusk, you can watch it go in 4 minutes from horizon to horizon. But it's just one of the myriad things that are happening in the world. But it's also a really amazing thing. But how do you get people to notice it? How do you get people to see it? And this was no great choreographed plan to record a David Bowie tune up there. It was just a project between my son and myself. But it came out really nicely. It came out quite exquisitely beautiful, far beyond what I thought it would. And I think the reason people found it interesting was because it's an iconic song. It's kind of a time-defining song, but it's an inherently beautiful song. Bowie's a genius. I mean, he's an original artist like almost no other. And to be able to take that song, which has always been fantasy and sort of a weird, dreamlike view of spaceflight, and to have it portrayed by a regular guy on board, for real, a spaceship that we built, and have the two of them come together, that becomes somehow hypnotizing a little bit to watch it. How can this actually be happening? Something that was pure fiction and art has become also reality. And it wasn't intended that way, but even I, when I watch it, it ends up being far more than just the actual components of it. And when you look at rebroadcasts, it's hundreds of millions of people have seen that that video clip. And what it really shows is the actual existence and capability of what we're doing in space exploration, beyond the press announcements and what the robots are doing and, the latest thing. This is what's actually happening. And if everybody could come up on the space station for a while, this is what they'd see. It's a wonderfully exquisite new extension of what we're doing as people, and a perspective on the world that you can't get any other way. And it was my best effort to help people come on board with me so that they could really start sharing the experience and maybe put it into perspective with everything else.
Obviously, free time on the space station, I mean, it's probably quite rare. I know that you had a game involving bubble wrap, getting that from one end of the station as quick as possible? Because are they like, oh my God, Chris is going to sing a David Bowie song, what are we going to do? Are you briefed about how far you can relax up there?
Free time's an oxymoron on the space station. Those two words are opposites. Time is so precious. And there is, if you take 5 minutes to look out the window, you have that, it's like you should be studying for an exam instead. That sort of feeling in your mind all the time. There are so many things that need to be done. And the station is a big complicated place and things are broken and there are projects and stuff that should be finished. But at the same time, you're there on behalf of everybody. You are the eyes and the ears and the hands, essentially, of 7 billion people. And if you fail to appreciate the place and pass on whatever your particular appreciation or understanding of it is, then to some degree you've let everybody down. And NASA is not some monolithic, emotionless thing. NASA is just a bunch of people, you know, that are all trying to do their best and have different objectives. And the engineers want the engineering done, and the scientists want the science done, and the operations people, you know, they want the equipment fixed. But there are also our photographers that want the Earth photographed, and there are the artists that want their artistic project done, and there are psychiatrists and psychologists and everyone else. And we, as the people on board, try and balance all that and try not to waste the time to make sure that there's never any free time, that if you have some time, that you are then doing something worthwhile on behalf of one of those constituents that really wants, if they could be there in person, the thing that they would want to do. And so each of us takes whatever skills we have and interests we have and tries to take them to the max, whether it's writing a blog or taking pictures or talking on the ham radio or playing music even, to try and help understand the experience.
And the book is called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. It might be a bit of an all-encompassing question, but I wanted to ask what space has taught you about life on Earth since you've been back.
It's probably worth remembering that, at least in my case, I was an astronaut for 21 years, and as of a year ago, I'd been in space 20 days. So one day in space for every year on Earth, it means that an astronaut's life is on Earth. It's one of preparation and support and invention and refinement and capability building as a regular human being on Earth to prepare to do something really complex and hopefully magnificent. And the lessons that you learn in preparing for spaceflight and then being successful in spaceflight and helping others, those are all lessons that are on Earth. It's not just the spaceflight itself that matters, but it's the enormous amount of learning and capability building that comes along with it. And that's why I wrote the book. The book is really the result of having spoken at schools and tried to distill out of the experience what is actually useful out of this. What can a regular person get from this esoteric experience? There are the scientific returns, the things that we invent and discover and the insight that we gain. There's the perspective of the Earth that we bring back, of seeing how your town looks in contrast with the rest of the planet. But there's also, how do you prepare to do something extremely complex, or how do you focus your life to do something that may never actually happen and still stay happy along the way? Or how do you deal with fear in your life? Do you just let fear keep you from doing something? Or do you say, you know, I know that terrifies me, but I want to figure out how to get around that and accomplish it anyway. And that's the only way you can get on a rocket ship, of course, or do a spacewalk. But the rewards are so enormous if you can figure out how do you deal with fear in your life. And so I've been speaking about those and analyzing those within myself for decades. And sort of the book is the culmination of all of those thoughts and presentations and things. And at this stage in my life, it made sense to try and write them down. And the book is done well, and I hope it's because people are finding it useful. People are actually seeing that those are useful ideas that, and beyond, amongst all of the art and music and science that comes from the space station, there's also hopefully some interesting thoughts that can be used on a daily basis.
That was Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall a little earlier on.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
We have a topical track. Should we have a bit of Space Oddity by Bowie?
Let's please.
Let's get Jack to cue it up. Here we go. It's Space Oddity.
Ground control to Major Tom. Tell my wife I love her very much.
That was David Bowie with Space Oddity. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. It's a 6,000-mile journey stretching from the ancient capital of Mongolia to the Danube River in Hungary. It's the trail of Genghis Khan. A difficult journey at the easiest of times, but what could it be like to retrace those ancient footsteps all on horseback?
Adventurer and author Tim Cope did just that. Tim trekked through wolf-infested plateaus, deep into virgin forest, and managed to save his pet dog from thieves that wanted to steal him and boil him up for supper. Tim is out with a new book titled On the Trail of Genghis Khan, and I caught up with him a little earlier when he swung by Midori House. Tim, thank you for coming in to see us. Let's, first of all, for listeners, plot out... There's an amazing map at the beginning of the book for the readers, but just plot out for people in their minds this epic journey from where it begins and where it ends.
Well, the dream of mine really was to set off from Karakorum, which is actually the old Mongol capital of the original empire that they set up, to ride a horse from this place right across the Eurasian steppes all the way to Hungary. Now, many people may think in their mind that somewhere Mongolia and Hungary might meet, but of course, you know, this inner core of the Eurasian continent is a vast place. Places like Kazakhstan, the biggest country of the steppe nations. Then you've got southern Russia, which bridges the Caspian Sea with the Black Sea. Then you've got all of Ukraine, which leads to the Carpathians. And beyond them lies the plains of Hungary and the Danube River. And the aim of the journey really was, apart from riding a horse on the trail of the Mongols, who under Genghis Khan created the largest land empire that's ever been, was to travel from one side of the Eurasian steppe to the other, because the Mongols were just one of many, many nomad empires that have come and gone since the domestication of the horse took place about 5,500 years ago in the core of Eurasia, in what's known nowadays as northern Kazakhstan.
Now, anybody who's listening will hear the richness of your Australian accent popping out every now and then. How does a boy from Oz fall for the steppes?
When I was 19, I was actually studying law in Australia and was very unhappy. I managed to find a way out, which was to study as a wilderness guide in Finland. And part of the course was in Russia. This was back in 98, 99. And at the end of that course, a letter arrived from the university to say, if you don't re-enroll, then it's assumed that you've abandoned the course. And at that stage, mind was far away from law. In fact, I'd learnt a lot about traditional survival in the forests of Finland. I'd spent 3 months in Russia at a time when the economy there had collapsed. There was an incredible spontaneity about the people. And I got a glimpse of a country that is the largest in the world and one that I knew nothing about. And I think that sense of everything to me was unknown as an Australian. The severity of the winters, the summers, the very idea that the Siberian tiger forests are in fact some of the largest tracts of unbroken forests in the world. Who are the people that live there, and what would it be like to travel and to be kind of be immersed among these people? And that's what set me on a course for that part of the world. I then spent 14 months on a layback bicycle known as a recumbent with my friend Chris, cycling across northwest Russia and Siberia. We were living on about $2 a day. I ended up getting frostbite. The bike snapped in half.
And having bits of your flesh cut out as well, I hear.
Yeah, I had the end of my big toes cut off by a Dagestani doctor in a small village called Babushkin in Vologodsky Oblast, or Vologodsky Province. And that was the beginning of a life-changing experience, a rite of passage and a coming of age in a way for me. I was 21 years old and getting to know myself and the world. But in the latter stages of that trip, we ended up pushing our bikes through Mongolia, or largely pushing, because we were going through the Gobi Desert, where there were mostly just these miserable sandy tracks, and these amazing nomadic people on horseback would just appear from over the horizon. They'd come galloping over, have a conversation with us more or less, and then head off wherever they pleased. And it left us feeling like wimpy tourists, just pushing our bikes along these predetermined paths. These people live in a world where it can be minus 50 degrees Celsius in the winter, it can be plus 50 degrees in the summer. The only thing separating from the people from these extremes are, in fact, the felt walls of their tents, known as girth, which are only a couple of inches thick. There's not even any forest there to provide firewood to fuel them, the heating through those cold winter months.
And when you decided to return to do the journey again on horseback, this journey in the end takes you 3 years, 3 years of your life. Now, you've got a book out of it now, and you've made a very successful TV program about it, a series about it as well. But when you set off on those first days, was there any kind of thought that this would be a book and a TV series, or was there just the journey ahead of you?
I've dreamed of being an author since I was 14 years old. So writing and capturing things is, for me, an intricate part of an experience, because it helps me to percolate out of what I've seen and done and felt what's important and what I might be able to share with others. But I don't think I could have imagined anything of the enormity that kind of lay ahead of me. I couldn't ride a horse, for one thing. And when I set sail, I think the thing which attracted me most was that not only didn't I know when the end was going to be, but for 6,000 miles ahead, not a single soul knew I existed. There was nothing about this that was pre-arranged or pre-organised. It's very difficult to do that in these countries anyway.
And you travelled, obviously, with your horse, and you have a relationship with the horse, and an amazing dog also that travelled with you, that you eventually brought back to Australia as well.
Yeah, I set off with three horses. I had at all times two pack horses and a riding horse. On the fifth day of the trip, in fact, two were stolen. I eventually recovered them, and the herder said, well, you know, they came to me themselves. You must have tied them really badly. He taught me this wonderful step proverb that a man on the step without friends is as narrow as a finger, and a man on the step with friends is as wide as the step. About 6 months later on, having been through several attempted horse steals, but having come to know the people and the culture a lot better, this man, Asset, took me into the first few weeks of winter, and he said, you need a friend on this long road, someone to keep you warm at night in the tent, and to protect you from wolves. And he gave me this scrawny little pup, Tigin, which means fast wind or hawk in Kazakh. And I didn't think he'd survive more than a couple of weeks. He was actually leaping off the snow onto my shoulders to get his paws out of the cold at that time. But of course, he grew into this wonderful, big, strong dog, and had all his own parallel journeys, including being stolen and hit and frozen and almost boiled alive in the summer when it was 50 degrees. But he made it to the end with me, and I couldn't have done it without him.
Now tell me, you come from a great line of writers, people like Patrick Leigh-Fermor, or Dearthler Murphy is quoted on your book. These people who, it's not travel writing in the sense of holidays or tourism, it's about going to parts of the world where you suddenly realise, even today when you're turning the pages of your book, I was reading the chapter just before we came on of about Kazakhstan, and you realise that there's lots of the world that's still quite empty, and you said that you were a long way away from people often on those times. Do you see yourself being in this line of people who, what's interesting also is you did complete the book, The Journey, a few, 3 years ago, actually a bit longer than 3 years ago, 6 years ago, but in a way it's a snapshot of the world, and it doesn't matter that it's changing, it takes you somewhere really rather unique. Do you see yourself being in that line of writers?
I mean, it would be an honour to be considered in the line of those writers, but I think some of my heroes were people like Wilfred Thaisiger and Dervla Murphy. Wilfred Thaisiger, I remember his journeys through the empty quarter of what is now today Saudi Arabia. And the thing that struck me most was his curiosity about the people and being immersed in their cultures, learning to see the world through their eyes. And I was struck when I reached the Danube that I'd been on the journey for 3.5 years, and it was almost as if the water was looking back at me to say, well, you know, I've been here all along, what took you So all this time? And in the modern world, adventure and exploration takes on a slightly different meaning, if you like, or a slightly different significance, because you can get in a plane from Mongolia to Hungary and probably be there in 6-7 hours. I could have walked faster, could, due to all the bureaucracy that, ironically, because horses don't usually go through borders these days, they held me up for 3 or 4 months, which is a story into itself. But it wasn't the point, because even in a world where we can see every inch of the Earth theoretically on Google Earth, there's no substitute for going out and engaging with the world. And if you get out beyond those beaten tracks, you suddenly begin to realise how little of the world we know.
Now, there's many amazing stops along the way, and I did have us in Kazakhstan a moment ago, but for the listeners, let's take us to one town along this huge route. It's a big book, and there's lots of pages that people need to delve into. But just let's give people an insight into what it's like on the road. Just tell us about one of the places you arrived at. You think that has a special place in your mind, for good or bad.
One of the places would definitely, for me, have to be a town called Akbakai, or also known locally as the place that God forgot. And I'd been riding out onto what's known as the Betpak Dala, which means the starving steppe. I'd been going for probably about 6-7 months on the road by this stage. It was getting very cold. In fact, it was dropping to minus 40 degrees. There was just enough snow cover in this kind of Arctic-like landscape to keep the horses hydrated, so they were eating the snow. But 2 days to Christmas, one of the horses had an abscess in its hoof. It was infected. It couldn't walk properly. The tent was falling apart. I decided that I had to evacuate to the nearest place, and it happened to be a dot on the map, about 100 kilometres away. I set off, pushed the horses really hard, and reached this place on dusk. I was kind of semi-frozen. I had become obsessed with the image of a family with a roast on the table and a barn full of hay and grain. But of course, in the end, there were just these two shadowy figures to greet me, and they took me back to the hut. And in the morning, I was introduced to Grisha and Vitka, these two Russian alcoholics who'd actually been stuck in their little mud hut in this town for a couple of years since losing their truck driving licenses drunk at the wheel. They said, "Don't worry about it, Tim. Sit back, have a cup of tea, have a vodka. We'll find you a wife." I headed off to look for hay and grain for the horses, came back and discovered that they'd gone out and caught a couple of street pigeons, which we boiled up for Christmas dinner. And that night, Grisha kind of entertained me with these gruesome stories. He said, "Tim, you've got to meet my wife. She's as honest as a woman as you'll ever find. The time that she murdered our friend in the kitchen, she called the police herself. And only another 8 years and she'll be out of prison." Mm. But I got stuck in the end in this place for about 3 months. I tried to leave many times. On one occasion, my dog Tiggan was actually stolen by unemployed mine workers who were catching stray dogs to eat to survive, and pet dogs. In fact, during that search for him, I learned a lot about this society that's essentially a legacy of what they called in Soviet times a monogorod, or a mono city that was exclusively revolving around one industry. My friend Baidak there said, "Tim, there's two types of people in our town. There are above ground thieves and below ground thieves." And half the population were descending, rappelling at times with ropes 400 metres into state mine shafts that had been abandoned, getting the gold, selling it on the black market. The others were paying bribes at the processing plant to take some and then process it. And it was this cat and mouse game where the police sheriff would drive around the town trying to catch people in the act.
Tim Cope's book, On the Trail of Genghis Khan, is out now. And you can guess why Tim is also an inspirational speaker, a guide who can take you out to those steps. I'm not sure that he'll make you eat the pigeon. But thank you very much for coming to see us.
Thanks a lot. It's a shame I couldn't bring my dog.
That was Tim Cope, author of On the Trail of Genghis Khan, speaking to Andrew a little earlier on.
Stay with us as we catch up with the singer-songwriter Lloyd Cole.
The Arctic has inspired artists for centuries with tales of adventure and exploration. Monocle Films made its own expedition to Denmark to see the Louisiana Museum's Arctic exhibition to seek out the past and the present of this mythic place.
As nations are vying for the north, negotiating trade routes and expanding development, and the Arctic landscape threatens to disappear, this exhibition takes a visionary stance that activates dialogue on every level, from science to pop culture.
Arctic Inspiration, premiering in the film section on monocle.com.
It's a little short of 30 years since Lloyd Cole announced himself with 1984's Rattlesnakes by Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, a still astonishing record of arch-literate pop that laid plausible claim to a venerable lineage of smarter-than-average songwriters, including Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen, and also established Cole as a peer of such contemporaries as Aztec Camera's Roddy Frame, Prefab Sprout's Paddy McAloon, and Orange Juice's Edwin Collins.
It's taken a little short of 30 years for the restless, unpredictable Cole to make another album that sounds quite as much like Rattlesnakes as his new record, Standards. It's his first record with a full backing band in nearly two decades, and it's a band which includes some of the musicians who played on his earliest recordings. And 30 years having elapsed, he's got his own son on guitar too. Lloyd came by Midori House and caught up with Monocle's Andrew Muller a little earlier.
Lloyd, first of all, about the new album, how much nerve did it require to title an album Standards?
About the same amount as Mainstream, I think.
What was the thinking behind the title?
I just liked the feeling of it. I knew it would piss off the people who don't like me.
Is it true that the album itself, rather than the title, was inspired to an extent by having to play Music Critic? You were asked to write a review of Tempest, I believe, by Bob Dylan, by Salon?
Yeah, true. There was an element in there. I mean, this seems to have been the thing that went in my press release and everybody wants to talk about it. But I was between, well, in the first 10 years of the 2000s, I think I was a little overly concerned with what was age-appropriate music for me to make. And I think I thought about it too much. And I think initially the results were good because I think Music in a Foreign Language is my favourite record that I've made, and that was the record that I made when I basically retreated. But I found myself writing rock and roll songs and not wanting to record them because I thought I didn't want to make rock and roll music anymore.
And was that a feeling that, for want of a better phrase, you were too old for that kind of thing or you'd grown out of it?
Both. I felt like I didn't really want to do it, and I thought that there was a sort of lack of dignity involved. You know, just look at numerous examples of people who go on for too long making rock music. And then I looked at Dylan making this record, and I just thought he's not thinking of... I don't think he knows how old he is. I really don't think he knows how old he is, and I don't think he feels like he's doing anything any different to what he did in 1965 or 1975. He's just an older guy doing it. And I thought, maybe that's a nicer way to think about it and maybe a less complicated way to live my life. I'll do what I write. What occurs to me is what songs come to me. How about I just try and just do them the way I naturally will do them rather than worrying about it? And so that's basically what we did.
So did you actually find yourself enjoying picking up an electric guitar again once you decided to do it?
Yes, once I remembered how to play one. yeah, absolutely. And you know, the other thing... I will admit to being slightly reactionary. Quite a lot of people refer to my last record as being Americana. My associations of the term Americana are not positive. So I just thought, fuck, excuse me. No acoustic guitars on this record.
But this is Broken Record you're talking about. Yeah. The very country-influenced one you made a few years ago.
Yeah, I personally thought it was Rod Stewart-influenced. With sort of mandolins and, you know, sort of rocking drum sounds, but with a lot of acoustic guitars and mandolins.
But you talk about that idea of making age-appropriate music. There are a lot of songs on this which are reflections backwards on youth and growing up, things like Period Piece and Kids Today. Was that, I guess, a way of offsetting the idea that you were making a rock and roll record, that you wanted to make a grown-up one?
I don't think I really thought about it. Just, I'm 50-something, and I have... 21-year-old child. It's sort of inevitable that these things will occur to me, I think.
A 21-year-old child who plays on the record and appears in one of the videos, I believe.
Yeah, and he's starting his own band in Brooklyn.
How hard is it to step away from that and let him do it? Do you keep trying to want to interfere or give him advice?
I think I have to. I think I have to because there were so many things that we did that, looking back, we could have done better, that felt like the right thing to do at the time. I think it's impossible for me not to at least... try and have his ear.
What kind of warnings have you given him?
Well, I think the most important thing, I think the main reason that the Commotions didn't last so long is we never allowed ourselves to enjoy our success. We enjoyed the first year of our being a band in public, but we leapt into making a second record because we'd allowed ourselves to be persuaded that we would be forgotten if we didn't put another one out soon, and we were insecure enough to believe that. People waited 6 years for the next Blue Nile record, and they would have waited 6 years for another Commotions record if we decided to take a little longer. So I think it's important. if you're making rock and roll music, that you can enjoy it, because if you don't, it transmits. And so I'm trying to make sure that he seems like he's 21 years old and he's already putting enormous pressures on himself to succeed immediately. I don't think he needs to worry. I think he's talented. He will succeed.
Did you really find that period, that commotions period, that difficult at the time?
The first year was very easy. And the second year felt easy. But, you know, it took another year passing to realise that we just got lucky on the first one, and there were no duff tracks on the first album, and there were quite a few on the second. But we proceeded exactly the same way, but we didn't have a holiday. I mean, I remember when we finally had a holiday in 1986 or 87, just before we started work on... Oh, before we started going on tour for mainstream, so it must have been the end of 87, my girlfriend and I went to Corsica for a week, and it was just on the seventh day I went, oh, I can finally relax, and then I had to go back to work.
Standards, the new album, strikes me as closer to the Commotions era records than anything you've done solo in the interim. I mean, it's a mixed blessing starting with an album like Rattlesnakes, isn't it?
No, it's not mixed. I mean, you know, would you like to have Astral Weeks or not? Yes, you want it. So would you like to have Rattlesnakes as your first album? Yes. I mean, having it to compare every record to it since, fair enough.
Do you get self-conscious? I was thinking of this specifically about what I'm pretty sure is my favourite song on the new album, which is Women's Studies. Whether writing now you get... You're one of those unusual lyricists, and I mean this as a compliment, that it's fairly... You can tell fairly quickly, even if you're just looking at the words, who wrote this, which I think is an increasingly dwindling part of the songwriter's craft. Do you ever get a self-consciousness about thinking that sounds too much like something that Lloyd Cole would write?
I think I absolutely did, yeah, and I think I retreated from... I think I'm naturally playful and slightly flamboyant with language.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
And I tried not to be for quite a long time. I thought that becoming more concise and becoming more subtle and becoming more understated seemed more age-appropriate as I got older. And then I started writing these songs on this record, and I just went... I have to admit, I felt exactly the same as you. I was like, I wrote some of this, and I went, that's fantastic, and nobody else could write that except me. Why on earth should I be worried about that?
But it's genuinely nice after, I think, especially if you have a history with a certain artist. And, you know, when I first heard Women's Studies, I did, and again, I mean it as a compliment, laughed out loud at the very Lloyd Cole-ness of it.
Yeah, and for me, I'm happy for you to laugh all the way through the record, because I think art without humour is really something I've got no interest in.
You do sort of another trope that has, I think, recurred on Standards with increasing confidence is the intertextuality, if you will, the cultural references, the references to literature and music. Do those come naturally, or are they a conscious decision? Because I mean, there's references on this to, you know, among many others, Blondie, Queens of the Stone Age, Joseph K, either implicitly or explicitly.
I just do it. Sometimes I don't even notice I'm doing it. You know, there's a few things on the record that people like yourself have pointed out to me, and I went, oh, yeah, there's another one. I just do it.
They don't come from anywhere in particular. There's no particular point or riddle you're trying to establish with them.
No, I mean, sometimes they just add a little something, maybe a little bite to a lyric, like, I should be the one touched by your very presence, dear. Obviously, it's referring to the Blondie song, but it's also adds a certain sarcastic tone to the line, which I think would be more than if I'd tried to say the same thing without using the line. So I don't think it's just, I don't think it's a one-dimensional technique. I think it's just sometimes, I mean, I feel most of the stuff on Rattlesnakes is enabling the songs to have possibly a visual quality or maybe a cinematic quality by using very few words. Something like Grace Kelly Carr, I think, gets an awful lot through in three words.
That was Lloyd Cole speaking to Monocle's Andrew Miller. And that's all, isn't it, for episode 233 of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew?
It is, Rob. We've only got one more to go before the end of the year. And if we make it there, I'll be surprised.
It was a bit hijinks, wasn't it, today? There was an amusing spirit in the I think
talking about it, we should have a drink after this. We deserve it.
Yeah, we've hardly had any this week. I think we should. What should we have? What do you fancy?
Well, I might have a glass of red.
Glass of red?
Yeah.
Really? You're feeling like
red or champagne? I don't mind. I'm not going back on
White wine.
That's another story. Anyway,
what happened? Is this going to be a Christmas party anecdote here?
No, it's not a Christmas party anecdote. It's another story. I'll tell you later.
Okay, you haven't been talking to your bag again.
No, I haven't been talking to my bag.
Or ringing yourself again.
I did get confused between my phone number and. I did try and phone myself from the office today. I phoned someone, and every time I phoned this person, my phone rang. I was getting really annoyed that I was being interrupted just as I was trying to phone someone. Because every time I went to get my phone, it stopped, and then I realised I was phoning myself. It's okay to do it once, but to do it multiple times
that's the way to do it.
Speak of the need of a holiday, I think.
It does speak of the need of a holiday. I think that's an interesting window for our listeners into how Monocle is made. Just about.
Well, Rob, it's been a very nice year.
It's been a good year, right?
Doing this with you. It's a kind of a high point of the week. It's kind of a chance to escape what's going on. So
yeah,
happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Andrew. And to all our listeners, it's been a good year. Stay tuned with us into 2014. Thanks to Isabel Kaiser. Thanks to Phil Hahn. And also our studio manager, Jack Phillips, who, quick as a button, quick as lightning, flashed in there with Britney's Hit Me Baby One More Time.
Because that was not set up at all.
Inspired.
It was genius. I said he is literally the David Blaine of engineers.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
It was a good trick.
It's magic. I always think he's the Paul Daniels of engineers. You know? slightly creepy.
We were just ending on a nice note.
Oh, sorry. I'll spank him later as well. So we should thank everyone for tuning in one last time, right, Andrew? Merry Christmas and thanks for tuning in.